Among the saints of this day, there is also a great prophet, the prophet Elisha, who was closely bound to the prophet Elijah. And because his teaching has a close relationship to the teaching of the Orthodox Church and to the truths of the Orthodox Church, I would like to take from this and to present to you tonight one piece out of the many instructive miracles that he worked. I don't know whether you know this. The prophet Elijah received a command from God, together with certain kings, to anoint Elisha as prophet in his place. So he went looking for him, and he went and found him in the field, plowing. Apparently he was, as we say, a great householder. It is enough for me to tell you that at the same time there were 12 yoke of oxen plowing in that field. He had others working for him, of course. But with the 12th yoke he was plowing himself. The prophet, without speaking to him at all, passed by beside him, took off his mantle, his cloak, and threw it over him. This was the sign of a calling. Without any discussion at all, Elisha at once let the plow drop from his hand, went over to him, and asked permission to go and say goodbye to his parents. He gave it to him. He went. He said goodbye to his parents, and he came back. He slaughtered the oxen, and for wood and for fire he used the plows he had, along with other wood. He distributed the meat to the people who were there, and he followed the prophet Elijah. He lived beside the prophet Elijah until the moment when the prophet Elijah was parted from him by a fiery chariot. He asked him, in fact, to bless him in those last moments. And when the prophet Elijah asked him, "What do you want me to give you?" he asked for a double portion of the grace of the Spirit. The prophet answered him that you are asking for a hard thing. But if you see me taken up from you, know that you will have it. And indeed, a little later, the prophet Elijah was snatched away in a fiery chariot, and Elisha was left alone. And he threw his mantle down to him from above, which Elisha took up, and he used it soon afterward to open the Jordan so that he could cross over. And so the prophet went on his way with twice the grace of the prophet Elijah. Now you understand what the prophet Elisha is from the point of view of grace in the eyes of God. If these events are read through, many things will be found there, and very instructive ones. I am taking a few of them, as I told you at the beginning, to show how this man appears at a given moment. We come to four kingdoms, that is 2 Kings chapter 5. There it recounts certain events concerning Elisha which took place on the banks of the Jordan. It is a period when he is living down there with an assistant of his, the one called Gehazi. It says that in Syria there was a general named Naaman, who was a benefactor of his own state. Apparently he had often shown great bravery. As a soldier he was evidently a strong man, as we would put it, and he was a great personage. He enjoyed great esteem. But he had one drawback. He was a leper. Listen to how Scripture says it. Holy Scripture says, "Now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great man before his master and held in honor, because through him the Lord had given deliverance to Syria. He was a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper." This distinction that Holy Scripture makes there can set us thinking too sometimes, if we are willing, of course, when it says there, "But he was a leper." Here one could say, a man with glory, a man with honor, a man who is great in the world, but a sinner. There it is, but a leper. Here it is, but a sinner. I don't know whether you know that leprosy is the type of sin. We have had the opportunity at another time, and we have presented, from the days of Moses onward, the types of sin. Leprosy, then, is the type of sin which is healed only by a miracle. Let this put us in a state of reflection, because we look to have a good testimony on the outside. A good name in the world, we manage to have good relationships, to have a decent amount of property, some freedom to come and go, knowledge, acquaintances, whatever it may be. But what about the inside? Could it be sinful? Could it be that in the meantime I am weighed down, that we have a leprosy of the soul? His was of the body, but what if we have a leprosy of the soul? Then all of that outward thing profits us nothing, because when sin is there in the middle of it, everything turns dark. You can imagine the happiness of this man, which anyone would have envied, to be a general, to have everyone standing at your hand, at your word. to be the man whom the state has benefited, and for every door to be opened to you, but you cannot caress your child, you cannot kiss your wife, you cannot eat with them, you cannot sleep beside them. Now do you understand how the thing stands? What a sorrowful thing it is. In any case, going on, it recounts the following. This general was carrying out campaigns. The campaigns were sometimes against the Palestinians and sometimes against the Hebrews, and they took many captives. Among the captives, they also took women, and among the women, they also took a young Hebrew girl, a little one. She was taken as a spoil of war and given as a servant in the general's household. And so this young Hebrew girl came to serve in the home of the general, who suffered from leprosy. She had been sent by God to serve this divine plan. But when she entered the house, she saw that there was no joy there. The whole household was filled with sorrow because of his illness. The lady of the house was distressed, and so were the children. Her husband was distressed as well, and now the child shared in that gloom too, because when you live in a house where someone is suffering, without even realizing it, you begin to hurt as well. You begin to grieve. You begin to share in people's pain. And one day, while she was with her mistress, a wish escaped her, and she said this, "Oh, my lady," she says, "if only my master were back in my homeland, he would be made well." How would he get well? That is the very place where he could be made well. The lady held on to this. She kept it, as we say, as something to hold on to. And when the general came home at midday, she told him, "You know, the little girl said such and such. Look, see to it. Find some way to go down there. It is the way we talk today. If you go to Russia, this can be cured. If you go to America, it can be cured. If you go to Holland, it can be cured." Something like that. That is roughly how the conversation went. Now, this man had freedom of movement. He was a general. He was the king's own man. The whole state was at his disposal. He could set off with servants and with money and so on, and go as an envoy from a greater state to a smaller one, so as to obtain the thing he wanted. So listen. And the Syrians had gone out in bands and had carried away captive out of the land of Israel a little girl, and she waited on Naaman's wife. And they gave her service in the general's house, and she said to her mistress, "Would God my master were before the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy." She spoke up. The little girl must have known from what had been handed down that Elisha had the power and the grace, it seems, from God to heal even leprosy, and Naaman went in. Naaman came home to the house, evidently from the office, as we were putting it. His wife reported it to him, saying, "Thus and thus said the girl, who is from the land of Israel. This and this is what the little girl said." And the king of Syria said, "Come, come here," he says to him. "Go, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." It seems that he said to the king, "You know, if I manage to reach Israel, I will be healed." So the king sits down and writes a letter to the king of the Hebrews, the king of Israel. "I am sending you one of my men. You are to heal him." Now you understand, when the other man over there received that letter, he was thrown into confusion, because he took it as a provocation that they were looking for an excuse to declare war on them. "What is he telling me? Am I God," he says, "to cure leprosy? So they are going to declare war on us." But they were seized with fear. They were distressed, thrown into confusion there at headquarters and so on. And word spread outside that Syria was going to make war on them, this report passing from mouth to mouth, and this distress and the anxiety of the headquarters staff of the army and of the king reached all the way south, all the way to Elisha down there by the Jordan in his hermit's cell. The elder laughed, and he sent word that they should send this gentleman down to him. And the king of Syria said, "Come, go, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." And he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver. He took a great deal of money with him, and 6,000 pieces of gold, and 10 changes of raiment, 10 suits, as we would say, to give as gifts. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel. It said, "Now when this letter comes to you, behold, I have sent to you Naaman my servant, so that you may heal him of his leprosy." And when the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his garments and said, Am I God to put to death and to give life, that this man sends to me to heal a man of his leprosy? What is this business? He is surely looking for a pretext to declare war on us. Know now, therefore, he says, and here the king is making a prediction. Know now, I beg you, and see that this man is looking for a pretext against us. You'll see, he says, nothing good will come of this. But when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his garments, he sent word to the king, saying, Why have you torn your garments? Let him come to me, and he will know that there truly is a prophet in Israel. Then Naaman came with his horses and with his chariot, up on his chariot, in all his grandeur, in all his glory, and he stood at the door of Elisha's house. When we say house, we mean Elisha's hole in the ground. And Naaman stood there outside. Elisha did not come out to meet him. He sent the boy out to him instead, and sent him this message. Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, Go and wash 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean now. This, you understand, was not at all what Naaman had in mind. Naaman had pictured the whole thing quite differently in his own head. If this is a man of God, and if it is in that sense that I am going to be made well, then he ought to come outside. He ought to receive me. If he really is a man of God, he ought to lift up his hands to his God, to entreat his God, that God would look upon his servant, and that I would be made well. But this business of going off and washing in the river that you just can't make sense of. Besides, I had rivers back in my own country. What is the Jordan next to the great rivers of Syria? Is it anything at all? The Jordan is barely enough to wet a goat. A little stream over there, a ditch in front of you, and he was the one who said it. What do you say? Back in my own country, he says, I had rivers, the Abana and the Pharpar, great rivers. I could have washed there, he says. Would I come here, traveling for 2 months by cart so that you can put me into this? He was saying all this from up on the chariot. He did not come down, and he turns the horses around to leave, with the Jordan right beside him, and he will not go. Do you know how many people are in that same position even today, sadly? And how many there have been down the ages because their own reasoning would not approve it? What orthodoxy teaches, what the gospel teaches, is supposedly ridiculous to them. Why should I go into the water, he says. What is this supposed to mean, he says. Going into the water. What is this supposed to mean, he says. Going and drinking wine and eating bread. That is how they speak about Holy Communion. What sort of thing is this? And who has the power, he says, to forgive me my sin? And is he any better than I am? Listen to how the man says it himself. I am putting it to you in simple words, just to give you your bearings. Naaman was furious, and he turned to leave, and he says, Look, I'm going, he says, because I said my own way of religion, my own way of being saved. I said, You said, but the question is what he said and what he says, not what you say and what I say. That is not what matters, what I thought or what he said. Surely he will come out to me. He will come out to meet me, for I am a general. Then he will stand and call upon the name of the Lord his God. And he will wave his hand over the place and heal the leper. That is how I think it ought to have been done. Are not the Abana and the Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be cleansed? So he turned and went away in anger, and many people say the same thing today. From what follows, it is clear that this man was not healed. Then, while he was still up there, as long as he stayed on his chariot, he sat there with his leprosy, he sat there with his own reasoning, he sat there with his own opinion, and with his leprosy as well. This is what happens with every one of us. As long as a person stays seated in their own pride, they are not humbled, and they will not accept the way that Christ points out to them. And Elisha, in this case, is the one sent by God, and he is the one pointing out this way to him. You must go and immerse yourself 7 times in the river, and you will be healed. He promises him that he will be healed. If you trust me, and in any case, you ought to, since you have come from the ends of the earth, from Lebanon, and have now journeyed to me here in Israel to the Jordan, then that means you are truly prepared to do anything about the leg afflicted with leprosy. It has hold of you, and wherever you go, you cannot escape it. No medicine can take you out of its hand. No one can, in spite of the means you have, the gold you have, the position you have. With all that you possess, you would have been cured long ago. There would have been no reason for you to come here. So reason tells you that you must come down from the chariot and do this. But he does not. He would rather leave with his leprosy than come down from his chariot, among his companions, among the servants he had with him. It seems there was one man with some sense, and when I say sense, I mean humility, who stepped forward. He was the lowliest of them. And what did he say? My father, he said to him, did he ask you to do something difficult? In other words, it was as if he were saying to him, if he had told you that getting well was going to cost a lot of money, what would you have said? How much is it? Do you want me to lay down one gold coin, two, five? What would you care? Just let me get well. And you would have written to your wife back home too, wouldn't you? Whatever we have, sell it. Go to the king, load it up, bring it here. And then money we can build up again, but our health we can't. Wouldn't you have done it? And he says, I would have done it. So now, he says, when he asks nothing of you at all, only that you go and find the mystery, why don't you do it? That is the whole thing. He is telling me to come down from my chariot. That is the secret. And I do not want to come down from the chariot. He prefers to stay on the chariot with his leprosy rather than come down from the chariot without it. That is what man is like. And watch the people who are being lost, the people who suffer, the people who live far away, who become nervous wrecks, who in the end lose their minds, who take their own lives. You will see what egoism they have, that they will not use in humility the means that the church and Christ urge upon them. Listen to how that young servant put it to him. One of the servants came near, it says, and spoke to him and said, My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more now when he has said to you, Wash and be cleansed? Why don't you do this thing? His egoism would not let him. Now someone might ask, What did Elisha want to teach by this gesture, by this instruction? Certainly the prophet never spoke, not only this prophet, but no prophet ever, never spoke on his own authority. All the prophets spoke through the Holy Spirit. This moment was a moment to show the worth of the Church of Christ, the one church. It makes no difference that in size she is not of the Abana and Pharpar type. Let certain people today take note of this, people who do not understand things they ought to understand, especially since Christ points these things out to them and puts his finger on them. Abana and Pharpar today are Protestantism and Papism. Millions of people, great rivers these, but they do not cleanse leprosy, not if you dip yourself in them 500,000 times. They do not cleanse leprosy. You must go to the Jordan with the seven mysteries and dip yourself seven times to the little Jordan, that is, you must go to Orthodoxy, to that Jordan which Christ sanctified with the seven mysteries. The Jordan is a type both of humanity and of Christ. This is something a person must learn and must know. He did not tell him to be washed once or twice or three times, nor, when he finally did come down from his chariot, was he cleansed at the first or the second or the third. No, he washed once, he washed twice, he washed three times, four times, five times, six times. At the seventh he came up, and it says here, as the text records, that his skin was clean like the skin of a little child. I do not know whether you have ever seen leprosy. It is a terrible disease. It ravages a person and causes immense damage. It can eat away an entire ear, an eye, the nose, everything. It is an extremely cruel disease. So for a person to be restored in this way is something that only the power of the Holy Spirit, grace, can accomplish. Otherwise, nothing at all can be done. Listen to how it puts it here. Then he went down and was baptized seven times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child. Like the flesh of a baby, his flesh was restored and he was made clean. I told you that the Jordan is a type, a prefiguration, both of Christ and of humanity. The Jordan has two springs, and from these it joins into one and comes rushing down with tremendous force through the Sea of Tiberias, and it pours out into the Dead Sea. That is humanity. which comes down from Adam and Eve and passes through here, through the valley of weeping, and goes straight for hell. Now Christ comes, and he enters into the Jordan. And as Christ enters the Jordan was turned back. Look, he says, right now the Jordan, that is, humanity, is pouring down into the Dead Sea. This sea is in the Jerusalem above. Things changed. Christ transformed them when he clothed himself in human nature while remaining divine, and came here, was baptized, and sanctified the Jordan. He sanctified humanity, placed it upon his own beast of burden, and left it at the inn so that it might be saved. The name Jordan is also derived from the Hebrew Yarden, which means rushing. And pouring down violently, because humanity really was rushing headlong toward hell. Then Christ came and called man back, and man no longer goes there unless he wants to go on his own before. He went whether he wanted to or not. Now, only if he wants to, only if he throws away the work God has done, refuses to accept it, and says, I want to go to hell. Then go to hell, my fine fellow. As soon as possible, whether he wanted to or not, man would go down to Hades, as we know that Christ descended into Hades. For everyone, both the righteous and the unrighteous, was in Hades. After Christ, things changed, and now we have hell and paradise. In this way, then, God gave a type, a foreshadowing, so that people would take heed and not be enamored of the great rivers, where there is no grace. For this little river has grace. If you fall into the great rivers, which have no grace, they cannot heal you. No matter how many times Naaman had bathed in the Abana and the Pharpar at Damascus, he would never have been healed. He was healed only there when he obeyed and entered the wonder-working waters of the Jordan River. This, then, is a lesson for us Orthodox Christians. This is something very serious and very instructive, and I would like to remind you of it, because sometimes we forget and start talking about quantities. So many will be lost, they say. So many millions from over there will be lost. I do not know whether they will be lost or not. One thing I do know, which way saves, what Christ teaches, that is what I know. And I know that they too can come in if they want to and see what is right. They have plenty of help, but they do not want to. They stay outside. Do the papists not see where the truth is? They do not see it. Are the papists not there at the All Holy Sepulchre? Do they not see the light of the resurrection every single year? Last year, when we kept Pascha together, did they not see that Christ gave the light of the resurrection to the Orthodox Patriarch and not to them? How is it that the Armenians saw it, the Copts saw it, the Abyssinians saw it, and they all received it from the Orthodox Patriarch? Why did the Catholics not receive it? And since for 2,000 years he gives them no light, why do they not repent and come to what is right, and admit that this is what is right? Is anything more needed? Is more testimony needed? Is philosophy needed? What is needed? These things we keep saying, how many they are. So then must he take a man by force, when the man does not want to come? How could that even happen? Our church, my beloved, has prayers for those who have fallen asleep, from the earliest apostolic days. Does she or does she not? Do you read or do you not read? Open the apostolic constitutions. Open the first liturgy of St. James, the brother of the Lord, and you will find prayers for the departed. How then can you, sir, as a papist, exclude the departed? If you die in papism, that is the end. They send you off with all your baggage. No one speaks of you again, and there is no sacrifice offered for you there. And second, there is no offering there. He is gone, he has died. They have closed the door on you. Nobody helps you. Where did he ever get such an idea? Man keeps on correcting God. How long is this going to go on? What good does it do that Abana is great, that Pharpar is great? There is no grace there, and where there is no grace, it is over hands up. Does Christ not want everyone to be saved? He always wants everyone saved. But what did he say, when I come, he says, will I find faith on the earth? What else did he say? Fear not, little flock, for to you the kingdom of heaven has been given, and that is because the others did not want it. No, it is not that Christ does not want them. He grieves over them, because it is people themselves who do not want him. They are his own creatures fashioned by his hands. They are the works of his creation. And he wants them to become his brothers and to become children of God. But to become his brothers, they must want it themselves. Because if a man does not want it, not even God himself can do it. All of this, then, is contained in the life of Elisha. And through Elisha, whose feast we keep today, he has shown us from that time on how we ought to think, and what it is that holds a man back so that he stays with his leprosy, and that there is no happiness at all where there is sin, and leprosy is the type of sin. And let us not deceive ourselves. Is there sin in the house, or is there superstition in the house? Then no happiness is created there, because happiness is spiritual happiness. It is not something from the outside, spitting blood onto a golden platter. Nothing comes of that. And yet we have not paid attention to this. Look at the great ones, the mighty ones, the ones we look to imitate as far as we can, with all sorts of schemes and swindles and this and that. Some of them killed themselves, some went mad, some lost their sleep. There is no happiness in it, none at all. Others were wiped clean off the face of the earth. Even their name was blotted out, not so much as their name is left. What happened was exactly what the psalmist describes. I saw the ungodly man, he says, lifted up on high like a laurel tree, and I turned away, he says, for just a moment, and then, no, he says, I did not see him, and I could not even see the place where he had been. Take the name of that man everyone talked about, Onassis. Is there still a name Onassis today? His only heir went first, then he himself went too, and now there is one daughter drifting from here to there, and even the name has been blotted out. This is a great lesson, a very great lesson. Take all those famous circles he ran with, every last one of them, top to bottom, not even their ashes are left. They were scattered, he says, to the ends of the inhabited world. A curse, a curse. And you called it a curse. We have no eyes, we do not see. And yet we imagine that happiness lies somewhere else. Happiness does not lie elsewhere. When sin comes between us, there is no happiness. Do whatever you like. Do not let this leprous body prevail, that is, do not let your sinful nature gain the victory. I say this in connection with the matter at hand in the few minutes I have to speak to you. And I will tell you the rest of the story too, because the rest of it also carries teaching. Apart from what concerns the character and the worth of orthodoxy, of the church, of the mysteries, and so on, and the work that Jesus did in the world, there is another teaching further on. So he returned to the man of God, he and all his company. They came back from the river, with their master now cleansed, and he stood before him, once again in front of Elisha's hermitage, and even now Elisha did not come out. He stood before him, once again in front of the hermitage of Elisha, and Elisha did not come out even now. He did not so much as look him in the face. He was not even curious to see who this general was, not even interested in going out to receive the thanks or to receive the gifts and so on. Nothing at all, as if nothing had happened. They came from outside, and Naaman said, "Behold, now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel." Now I understand, he says, because surely a great man like this, where else could he have turned for his health, just as we go round the whole globe and even sell the goat we own? And that is how it is. You cannot simply give up on someone you love, or on yourself, as long as you still have something left. As long as you have breath in you, you will spend everything you have, even if you're going to die. You know beforehand, from the very outset, that you will die, yet you will still make the sacrifice. So it seems that he too had gone to other places seeking healing. That is why he says, "Now I understand, I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel." Therefore he says, "Please accept a gift from your servant, allow me to give you something." He had money, he had various talents of silver with him, garments and other such things. And Elisha said, he answered, "As the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will not accept it." And Naaman pressed him to accept, but he would not yield. "Impossible, I take nothing." And Naaman said, "If not, then let there be given, I pray you, to your servant. Since you will take no gift yourself, then let something be given to me now." Do you know what he asked for? two loads of soil from Israel to take back with them to Syria, to spread that soil out on the ground, Israelite earth, the land of Israel, to spread it on the ground and stand upon that sanctified soil when he prayed. He could not stay there in that sanctified land in what we call the holy places. So he would take that soil back there to his own homeland. He would lay it down and stand upon that Israelite earth in order to pray to God. I pray you, he says, let there be given to your servant two mules' loads of this earth, for your servant will no longer offer whole burnt offering nor sacrifice to other gods, but only to the Lord. To him, the God of the Israelites, in this one thing may the Lord forgive your servant. When my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I bow down with him, I will bend my knees there in my own place. May the Lord forgive your servant in this thing. And Elisha said to him, Go, he tells him, in peace. And he departed from him a short distance. He took nothing himself, but he allowed Naaman to take the soil, and Naaman set off to return to his homeland. However, Elisha had with him a young assistant whose name was Gehazi. The young man had been listening to the conversation that this master was offering to give them certain gifts, and that Elisha refused to take them. That did not sit well with the young man. He thought, we did not ask for them. If we had asked, that would have been wrong. But since he is giving them to us, why should we not take them? He interpreted it according to his own reasoning. The demon on the right hand devoured him. And Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, Behold, my master has spared this Naaman the Syrian by not accepting from his hand what he brought. Just look at him, Gehazi says. The poor soul felt sorry for him and did not take it. Well, that is his affair. But as the Lord lives, and here he swears an oath, I will run after him and take something from him. And so Elisha was inside while young Gehazi was outside. The others had gone their separate ways. The young man now runs after the carriage and catches up with it. They had gone a mile or two ahead, some kilometers, I do not know how far, and from a distance they saw the young man coming. That something must have happened. The general gives the order to stop the chariot. The chariot stops. They all get down, and he gets down too. What is it? He says. Is everything all right? First thing in the morning like this. We're fine, he says. Don't worry. Well then, what is it? How? Why have you come running after us? And he says, Look, over there on the other side there are some of the sons of the prophets, and they were stripped bare with nothing at all to wear. And they've just now come over that way, and so somehow it came into my head to come and ask you, he says, for a few of the clothes you have with you, so we can put something on them. You offered them to us anyway, so do not carry them back home and be offended. Thank you. Give them, I pray you, a talent of silver and two changes of garments. And Naaman said, Be pleased to take two talents. And he pressed him, and gave the two talents of silver in two bags, together with the two changes of garments. And he laid them on two of his servants. You won't have to carry a thing, Naaman tells him. He sent down two of his own men and loaded them up. You'll take these down for him. And now Gehazi was strutting along with his hands free, swaggering, while the others walked behind, loaded down with the gifts. When they got close, Gehazi says to them, You still have a long road ahead of you. Give them to me. I'll take them from here on down. Don't wear yourselves out. I can manage them myself. So the other two thanked him and went off. And he took them and went and buried them, dug them into the ground, hid them away, so that he could dole them out little by little at the right moment. Once he had them sorted, once he had them all put away in order, in he came to Elisha, breezy and swaggering, as if nothing had happened. The moment he stepped inside, Elisha had him right there on the spot. And this is what Elisha said to him. And Elisha said to him, Where from, Gehazi? Where are you coming from? He says to him. And he said, Your servant went nowhere. I didn't move, I didn't go anywhere, I was right here. And Elisha said to him, Did not my heart go with you? When the man turned back from his chariot to meet you? In my mind, he says to him, Did I not see you when the general got down and came to meet you? He says to him, Is this a time to take silver and to take garments and olive groves and vineyards and sheep and oxen and men servants and maid servants. And maid servants too, is that what we came here for? Such business as this? Is that why we came here? Of course it is a monk who is saying these things. That is what someone will say, and that is precisely how the devil will present it to us. Well, he was a monk. What need did he have of vineyards and fields? But we are only concerned with what is necessary. We suffer for want of the necessities. Oh no, for superfluous things which will remain here, while our nephews quarrel over them, and our brothers come to blows over them, and they drag us a million miles down into Hades. Do you know how many people are like this? How many will be ruined by our own greed, and how the accounts against us will keep coming due? The reckoning never ends, and the files are never closed on those who amass things here that they did not need and did not give away, even though they seemed respectable and good. But all these things they gathered up before the things they gathered perish. So this, he tells him here, is what it has come to. Therefore, he says to him, for what you have done, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your seed forever, always. Everyone born of you will be born a leper. And he went out from his presence, a leper, white as snow. Naaman left his leprosy behind in the Jordan, and Gehazi picked it up, along with the sets of clothing and the talent of silver. Because leprosy is a type, a figure of sin. If he had not sinned, he would not have had such a problem. He sinned, and that is exactly why the leprosy was passed on to him. Do you remember the 10 lepers who were cleansed as they went along the road? What did the Lord say to them? The Lord says, go and show yourselves to the priests. They set out, and all of them were cleansed. One came back to give thanks, and the Lord reproached them, saying, were not all 10 cleansed? Where then are the 9? Where are the 9? They removed the leprosy from their bodies and placed it in their souls. Until then they had been lepers, now they had become ungrateful, and it would have been better for them to remain lepers than to become ungrateful toward God. The leprosy is transferred from the body to the soul. Leprosy is mentioned because there is a leprosy of the body and a leprosy of the soul. If anyone were willing to read through the events of Elisha's life, he would come to hold him in great esteem. He taught a great many things through the miracles he worked. He stood by the orphan. He stood by the widow. He stood by the poor. I was speaking once years ago in Agio. I do not know whether it was on this same day, and I spoke about these events, and I spoke in particular about one chapter earlier, the 4th chapter, where it says that a widow with many children found herself in a desperate moment when the man she owed was selling her and her children to get his money back. She had nothing at all. Her husband had died and left her out on the street in debt, and now this man who had lent the money was selling off the family to get it back. So she went to Elisha to ask him to do something for her somehow. So what does Elisha say? It's as if he were saying, do I have savings and shares, as we'd put it today? Nothing of the sort. What are you asking me to do? True, but you have God, and if you have God, then all things are possible. So he stopped, and he thought about it. Do you have anything in the house? He says. And she says, I have a little jug, an oil jar with just a drop of oil at the bottom. Very well. Send the children out to collect every tin they can from the neighborhood. Fill the house, he says, with tins, and when you have filled it, take the children inside and shut the door and start pouring, he says, with that little bit of oil into the tins, and as each one fills up, set it aside. And indeed, that is what she did. She began pouring oil into one tin, then another, and another. All the tins were filled, and there were no more left. So the children ran to her and said, all the tins are full. Then the little oil jug stopped pouring, since all the tins had been filled. Go on, he says, sell this now, and pay off that debt. This is the prophet of God, and may we have his blessing.